Angel. You don't need to know who I am, but you should know why I'm here. My grandpa, Stephen, is the author of a new exciting play called When the Break Happened in Orangeburg County. It's about our ancestors from when the break happened in 1865 until now. Many of my relatives are featured in the play, from my great-great-great-grandpa Stephen to my great-great-grandpa Stephen to my great-grandpa Stephen to my grandpa Stephen. Guess what my uncle and cousin's name are? Stephen. Go to www.thebreakinorangeburg.com to learn more. An online store has been created to honor those relatives and other families with products featuring the Break logo. Go to www.thebreakstore.com to purchase items today and help to produce this play. Please!
Welcome to a new podcast show about stuff. It's the show about stuff, the Stephen Davis Show. Here's your host, Stephen Davis.
Welcome to this week's episode of the show. Today, we continue the wonderful journey and interview with the McBroom sisters.
Now come to Durga and Lorelei.
I am predominantly a singer, although I was so encouraged by watching Marcia and Dana, I wanted to be like them. So I started playing piano at 4, and by the age 6, I was doing recitals. And then by the time I was 8, I was singing and playing guitar. Performing was always my thing, but I really did want to be a dancer. Dance first, actress second, singer third. I thought, I'm not going to make a living being a dancer, so I gave that up. I had a traumatic experience acting in high school where a boy that I really had a crush on since elementary school and I starred in a play where he had to kiss me. And I was so embarrassed that when he kissed me, he went for it. He tongue and everything. I wasn't ready. And the embarrassment kind of made me, it was silly, but I just said, okay, no acting. So I pursued the singing.
Wait, was that Stefan?
No, Jeff Zoetlin.
Jeff Zoetlin. He was cute.
I know. Cute. I didn't expect it, and I just wasn't ready. And I can't remember how old I was, but I was a young teenager. Anyhow, I'm glad that I picked music. I was fortunate enough that after doing the work that I said with Nile doing background vocals, I met through a friend of mine, Pink Floyd. They needed 3 background singers. Durga was in town at the time. She was working on an album I was making with Nile, and I sent a tape, a couple Polaroids. I met another girl, and they hired us. So that got me started with the background singing thing. Unfortunately, my deal with Capitol fell apart. The record company president, all the way down through everybody, got fired. So I didn't have any real allies on the inside. But fortunately, Pink Floyd called again because one of the girls had left. So I got to do Your Russia, late 80s. I first met Pink Floyd in 87 and then toured again. The first few shows in Atlanta, then they took me to Los Angeles, asked me to go on the world tour. I said, I've got a record coming out, take Durga. So they took Durga, I'll let her tell her version of what happened with her, but she ended up doing that. I did Johnny Kemp, which was great. I got to go to Japan with Johnny. He was so wonderful. I met him through Durga. So there's a whole lot of this thing of sisters looking out for each other.
I remember when Johnny Kemp used to be one of the performers at the Cellars or 95th Street.
I love Johnny.
After Johnny and the trip to Japan, I got the Rolling Stones. That was probably the hardest job I've ever had to audition for because there were 200 girls. It was down to me and 2 other girls. Mick clearly liked me, so he helped me. After the Rolling Stones, which was incredible, we did the first IMAX film ever made for music. So everybody was like 30 feet tall and it really felt like you were at the concert because the quality of the sound was incredible. That was a great experience. I met my son's father doing that.
That was fun too, Lorelei, because I was able to thanks to you, take my students from high school to see that IMAX performance.
She's being very modest because she did a duet with Mick Jagger
in the film.
Yeah, that's true. Yes, it was fabulous.
That was just a really incredible experience. My Gimme Shelter did not make the film. Lisa Fisher had been doing the Rolling Stones. She's got a 5-octave range. She's incredible. And the year that I got it, she was on tour with Luther Vandross. That was an experience for me of having to learn how to sing to that last person at the back. I was so concerned about, was I on tune? How did I sound? That I wasn't thinking about work that stage. And the Stones really helped teach me how to do that. Mm-hmm. And I will always be grateful for that. I've got a story that I always tell that Durga helps me tell because she's good at accents and I'm not, but it's worth retelling. I had been preparing for the show. It was late, very late at night, like 3 o'clock in the morning. I get a call from Keith Richards to come to his room. So I come and see, okay, what's going on? He says,
oh, okay.
Fill in the Keith part.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, we're about to come to my hometown. This is London we're coming to, and you're having a problem with Gimme Shelter. So tell me what's going on.
So I said, the thing is, Mick keeps shoving me when I'm singing. I asked the monitor guy to turn me up. They're not listening to me. Because he said, I know you've got what it takes to do it. What's going on? So then he turns around. Go on, Durga.
So Keith goes, look, this is my fucking band. And if I'm giving you steak, I'll fucking do it, all right?
So the next night, the sound was great. Mick wasn't shoving me. And the next day, we're leaving. The tour's over, because that was like our last run was in London. And Keith's manager says to me, look, you got a great review in Rolling Stone. They said your performance was incendiary. I'm really happy that's how it turned out in the end. But again, for people who are coming up, since really realistically speaking, I'd only been on tour 2 times before the Stones. So I didn't have years of experience. Most people, you build up to being on a tour of that caliber, where mm-hmm. we had private jets. They literally opened the airport for us when we were in Prague. That's like on a whole nother level. Pink Floyd Live in Venice was before. That was phenomenal as well. That was an incredible experience. There's a bunch of concerts that we've done that were historical. That one and the concert in Russia. We were there with Pink Floyd, Durga and I in 1990. That was the most incredible, I think, concert I've ever done, because the people there were so starved for this Western music. They knew the music, and the poor people were rushing the stage, throwing their hats at us, throwing money at us. It was just unbelievable. We were crying. They were crying. It was great.
Why that was so special, because when the show started, we were the first rock band invited by the state when this was still the USSR. We were invited by the government. And the security at the gig, it was done at the Olympic Stadium in Moscow, was the KGB and the Russian army. I had never seen a show like this before. The people were freaking out. There's lasers and the lights and the guitar, and they were jumping up involuntarily, screaming and shouting and gesticulating wildly. And of course, the KGB is like, be quiet, sit down, yet, shut up.
It was the way they were dragging people away. It was like they were taking them to the Siberia or something. They were rough.
That's what I just said. It's like they were dragging them off to the gulag. So in the middle of the show, our security had to go to the head of the KGB force that was there and say, look, this is a rock show. It is normal for people to have these reactions. It's emotional. Let them have fun. Relax. Just relax. By the end of the show, the Russian army guys were the ones also who were crying, and they were throwing their hats on the stage. I've got a Russian army hat in my bedroom. They got so emotional too.
It's interesting though, because when I saw you guys perform at the Meadowlands in New Jersey, when I saw that concert, it was like unfrigging believable. I said, there is no reason for war ever again in this world, because you had a huge stadium of like 50,000 people in harmony with each other. And it was like, it was really transformative to hear this music and to see how the production was put together. And so definitely war is something of a bygone era. There should not be any war ever again in this planet Earth.
You and Durga, I want to know this question. When you walk out on the stage and there's 50,000 people in front of you before you say a word, what are you thinking?
It's exciting. I love a big audience, and we've performed in front of 350,000 people. In Venice was seen by 350,000 people. I've done live shows with over 200,000 people with Rod Stewart, with the Rolling Stones. I love it because the thing is, and this is what I tell young girls that may not have the experience, I say, you have to understand these people are coming because they want to like this show. This isn't like Showtime at the Apollo or some talent show. They know they like this band. So keep that in mind. They're there to want to like you. And they will if you put on a good show. So just do a good show.
Okay. I tell people, I learned this a long time ago. When you're about to go on, you have to think to yourself, you're either going to suck or you're going to be somewhere in the middle. So freaking out over it is not going to make any difference. At this point in my career, I don't suck, ever.
That's another great piece, though, that's on YouTube, is to see Lorelai and Durga do Great Gig in the Sky during Lorelai's Ozzy tour, because there's an incredible Ozzy tribute band for Pink Floyd, and Lorelai is the only one who's in that band who actually played with the real Pink Floyd. So to see the two of you do that Great Gig in the Sky, which Lorelai, you can explain to them what the meaning of that pieces. I had never known it. It was just a beautiful vocal piece for me until you explained it to me.
Great Gig in the Sky is about death. Mm-hmm. It's very famous. It's the only Pink Floyd song that has a female lead on it, and she's not singing any words. They didn't want any lyrics. They played her the music. They said, just sing something. She started singing, Ooh, Baby. They said, no, just sing something. And she ad-libbed the most incredible. What we split it into three parts. The first part, it's loud, it's aggressive, it's hard hitting, because it's like you're fighting dying. No, I'm not going to die. Hell no. And the second part is a little bit more reflective. Like it's almost like the sorrow that you're realizing you really are going to die. And then the third part is you've surrendered to it and made peace. The way that Durga and I did it together as a duet, she came to visit me. I've been singing with the Australian Pink Floyd since 2011. She came as a guest and she was like, let's try it like this. And she came up with this beautiful idea of us trailing each other, singing the part at the end, which makes it into a harmony. Yeah. And it's had over 1 million views on YouTube. It's really special.
It is amazing. It is amazing. When I would go to your concerts, and you don't see many African-Americans at these rock concerts, mind you. And so somebody will say like some smart ass thing to me. And I say, I'm coming to see my sisters perform on that stage. And it was, oh my God. Then everybody's, oh my goodness, your sisters? And I'm like, yes, my little sisters, look at them. It's very exciting, very exciting.
I was going to say a couple of things. First of all, Richard Wright, who was the one who wrote the music behind that piece, is the one who set it up as a three movement piece, where the first, the raging at God, and then the sorrow and the upset and I'm realizing I'm going to die and there's nothing I can do about it. And then the peace and the acceptance. We have a mutual admiration society. Lorelai and I were greatly influenced by having big sisters in the movies and dancing at the Met and writing this amazing music. So we just carried on in their footsteps, really. But I will say this, that our father basically appreciated and prized in education above everything else.
Oh, yeah.
Because the only way at his time in his life that a Black man could succeed in the United States was by having an education. And he was the first of 14 children?
13.
So they were originally 15 and the two passed away.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he was the first to go to college and he put himself through college. And Marcia and Dana both got degrees. Lorelai and I did not. And I did go to UCLA. I started as a theater arts major. I went there until I realized just how racist the casting was in the school. I was in a production every quarter when I was there, which is really good because the teachers really liked me. But I started to notice a pattern. I played a maid. I played Tituba the slave. And then when they were doing a main stage production of Shakespeare,
Of course, as a young actor, I'd fallen in love with the bard. No, I was taking a Shakespeare class. And so I was thrilled that there was going to be a main stage production of Shakespeare. So I went out to audition for it. And the professor was, anyway, I'm still mad at him. He was, oh, you're so amazing. You must be really familiar with this material. Oh, he was all obsequious. And I was just like, ugh. Anyway, so I was really excited. He brought me to final callbacks and I thought I'm a shoo-in. And when he posted the cast list, I was not cast so much as a walk-on in the street, in the village crowd scenes or whatever. And I was so upset that I planned a meeting with him. And I asked him, why did you butter me up so much or basically blow smoke up my ass? And he said, oh, a director must think of staging. And you're so striking. You draw the eye. And I was thinking, of, and I'm thinking, isn't that what you want for your leading lady? Then he goes on to say, and I was thinking of you for the role of the courtesan. So in other words, he was thinking of me to play the hooker, which is what all Black actresses played at that time. Mm-hmm. And I was so mad, I left school, but luckily the right decision. I figured if I was going to put up with that kind of racism in casting while my mother was paying them thousands of dollars, I might as well put up with racism in the real casting world and have them pay me. So 6 months later, I cast in Flashdance, which was great.
Hey, Durga, you are so much like the name of my show, the show about.
And as Lorelai mentioned, I did a lot of films, and I was like the video queen in the 1980s. I did videos with Janet Jackson and David Bowie and David Lee Roth. I did 4 of his solo videos in California Girls, Just a Gigolo, Yankee Rose.
That came through the guy who got us the Pink
Floyd. I did all these videos and I was noticing a pattern again. I was in an episode of Hunter. I was, of course, playing a prostitute, walking on the host role in Hollywood Boulevard. There was a serial killer, this English lord who was going around killing prostitutes. And I didn't find out until years later, I was acting opposite Gary Sinise. That was cool. He was so creepy that none of us wanted to talk to him because he's one of those method actors that really stays in character the whole time. And he was playing a serial killer who liked to kill prostitutes. So he was giving off all the like, ew vibes he could.
Yes, who?
Gary Sinise is a very well-known actor who's been, he was Lieutenant Dan in Forrest Gump, for one thing. What other films is, he's been in a lot of films. He was in The Bear with Danny DeVito. Who he also played a very creepy Nazi white supremacist kind of character in that. Gary Sinise is a very well-known actor.
Wasn't he in the first version of The Stand?
Oh,
Stephen
I think
King?
He was. Yeah, I think he was. But he's got an extensive resume. Lorelai was doing this album with Niall. And at that time, I started seeing, I was playing hookers and prison inmates. But it turns out that all those qualities that stood against me as an actress stood in my favor as a singer because everyone wanted the big Black backing vocalist. I had this little college band and I got fired from that band. They feel so stupid now. She went on to sing with Pink Floyd. I was singing backing vocals for Lorelai, and the man who ran the production company doing the live concert videos for Pink Floyd recommended the two of us because David Gilmore, as he put it, wanted to quote unquote add some color. They had 2 singers. They wanted 3 more. Lorelai and I and our friend Roberta Freeman, who went on to sing with Guns N' Roses, went down to Atlanta. We walked backstage. And because I've been a Pink Floyd fan, I was a rock chick from very early on. In fact, I got Lorelai into the Stones when we were kids. I was into progressive rock. I was into Jethro Tull and a lot of bands like that. I knew who Pink Floyd was. I was a big fan, had Dark Side of the Moon, loved that album growing up. But we didn't know what any of them looked like because they made a point of not being on their album covers and not splashing their faces all over everything. They wanted the music to be the stars. So when this man came backstage with an acoustic guitar and said, hello, let's go over some of the parts, shall we? I didn't know who it was. And he starts singing and I'm like, oh, that's it. We were supposed to watch the show that first night and then film the next couple of nights. And he said, oh, you sound quite good. Would you like to have a go? And this is one thing Lorelai and I always tell people. We do master classes together. We teach voice classes and about the business. And one of the things we stress is when opportunity knocks, you better answer the door.
Because we could have been
quite afraid. Oh, I'm not sure. Let's. We were like, yes, we're ready. And we freaked out later.
Yeah, but it was a happy freak out.
Yeah. Yes, it was. But the minute I walked on stage, I felt this calm And I looked around at 15,000 people. I hadn't been on stage in front of more than 300 people before that. And I knew I was home. Mm-hmm. And subsequently, Lorelai did a couple of shows at the sports arena. And then I joined the tour. Mm-hmm. And I stayed with them through the last shows in 1994. And I'm on the last four albums, including The Endless River, which came out in 2014.
I'll never forget when Lorelai got her opportunity to sing with the Stones. She was so frantic getting herself together that she accidentally put her ticket in a mailbox. You remember that, Laura? Oh,
that was when I was getting ready to do the audition. It was the second phase, gone through the 200 girls phase. Now it was like 20 of us and they were flying us to France. And yes, the day I was leaving, I had gathered all my bills along with the voucher for my taxi and the airline ticket and put it in the mailbox. I panicked. I was like, oh my God, what am I going to do? I went to the airport with all my ID. It's me. Doesn't matter. You don't have the ticket. You can't take the flight. Go back home. Get a hold of Durga. I don't know what to do. I can't afford to fly on my own. She knew someone from Pink Floyd that was working for the mm-hmm. Stones, and she called her. She sorted everything out. There was no problem. But it's interesting, again, as far as people learning something from experience, there was one other girl that was coming from New York that I had seen in the audition who was a phenomenal singer. This girl could sing circles around anybody that's out there now or has been. She didn't have a great look, but when it came down to who it should be, it was her and the girl that got it. Mick said to me, who do you want to work with? And I said, this other girl, she's really got a great voice. You could fix her hair because they had plenty of money. We had designer clothes and mm-hmm. anything you want, they were going to pay for it. Mm-hmm. And I knew she just needed to fix her braids. Mm-hmm. But I said, she wasn't very nice because when I called her to tell her that I had gotten stranded and how worried I was, she could care less. She didn't speak to me in the cab on the way to the airport. She was just not friendly.
Oh my God.
And wow. So he said to me, the thing is, when you go on tour, you got to live with people for a few months. Right. So you want to be with somebody that's nice. I have always thought back on how that could have been that girl's moment because she still went on and did some independent dance records and whatnot, but she didn't get that break.
This is where I go back to our ancestors because that's what Maya Angelou always says. People may not remember what you did, but they remember how you made them feel. And one of my mother's very best friends was Mary Lou Williams. And I remember a story that, because that's how I became a choreographer. Mary Lou Williams asked me to choreograph to this suite that she had written for St. Martin de Porres. And I felt so privileged that Mary Lou Williams had asked me to choreograph. So I did it. I didn't even ask about arrangements for money or anything. And when the choreography was finished and I was getting ready to leave, Mary Lou Williams called me back and she handed me a check. She said, now you can tell everyone you're a professional choreographer because you have gotten paid. And I will never forget that moment. She always had so many hilarious stories. One of her best stories to me was when she said that young European American guy came to her with an introductory letter from Duke Ellington because Mary Lou Williams did a lot of Duke Ellington's arrangements. And he came, he says, oh, here, I have this letter of introduction from Duke. He said that you could teach me about jazz and teach me about music. Mary Lou opened up this letter from Duke Ellington and it said, don't teach him a damn thing.
Listen to this, Stephen. It's funnier than that. It said, take his money, but don't teach him.
After the first Floyd tour that I did, they said, you should move to London. The guys in the band were like saying that I could make a lot of money singing in the UK, because we all know the US music business was very racist at the time in that you had to do R&B if you were black or funk or something like that. You couldn't do any other kinds of music. The UK was a lot less strict in that regard. You could branch out and do a lot of different kinds of music. When Lorelai and I did Pink Floyd Live in Venice, the bass player of Pink Floyd at the time was Guy Pratt. And he had an old school friend whose name is Youth. And Youth is the bassist for Killing Joke and has worked with countless groups like The Verve, Paul McCartney, and actually wound up co-producing the last Pink Floyd album, which is why I wound up on it. He came to the show and he came up to me and said, like your voice, man, I'd like to make you a star. And we started working together. And the first song we wrote was called Naked in the Rain, and it went to number 4 in the British pop charts, number 2 in most of the European charts. And subsequently, we had a number 1 in the US dance charts with Can You Feel the Passion? We had 4 top 40 hits, basically. So I moved to London and I lived there for many years and was a pop star. I was on TV and all that kind of stuff.
And tell them about Blue Pearl. The video is so incredible too.
The first video that we did for Naked in the Rain was too racy to be shown on American MTV at the time. We had two different videos.
That's some great stuff.
I all want to do a 360 and bring it back to our parents.
I was going to spend this time talking about your mother in particular. So one of you all, you, Marcia, or you started off in terms of what happened.
My mother, here again, very interesting. My mother dealt in commodities and connecting buyers and sellers. She went to Nigeria and she was connecting some people in the US who wanted to buy oil with some oil sellers in Nigeria. I used to speak to her every day. Even though she was in Nigeria, we would call every day. And one day I call and someone else answers the phone in her hotel room. Oh, so people keep calling here for this Miss McBroom and we don't know who it is. So I call the front desk at the hotel. Oh, we don't know anything. Maybe your mother went to visit friends over the holidays or something or in the country. And I'm like, no, she would not just take off and not tell us. And this went on where we didn't know where my mother was for about 4 months. And then all of a sudden I get a call in the middle of the night, like it was 2 or 3 in the morning. Hello, are you Dan Amano? Yes. I was being held hostage with your mother in Lagos and I've escaped and I have your number. She was held for 13 months in this horrible maximum security prison, Rekeri prison in Nigeria. And the stories of that incarceration were horrific. My mother came back and was telling us about her experience. And my mother, for part of that incarceration, she went on a hunger strike. All she was doing was drinking water. She said to get her off of it, they would bring her water with all sorts of bugs and things floating in it. She said that's the only thing she was doing was drinking water. She said all she could do was hold it and wait till everything settled to the bottom and she would have to drink that water.
There was one very strange night where Dana, our sister Edie, and I, all three of us had the same dream that we were visiting my mother at Cary Prison. That for me was the most unbelievable thing. Wow. We called each other up the next day to say, oh my God, I had this dream. It was so realistic. And it turned out all three of us had the exact same dream.
And the other weird thing was my daughter Chainana is grown now, but she was little then. I guess she was about 7 years old or so. And when my mother came back, everyone came to New York to see her and hear about what had happened to her, all of our family members. We were sitting in my living room in this room that I'm in now. This is why I say spirit is real. My daughter never had a piano lesson or anything. But while my mother was being held hostage, I used to play this gospel tune whenever I got depressed. Call, please be patient with me. God is not through with me yet. I played it all the time. And all of a sudden, while my mother's talking to us, Chainana gets up and goes over to the piano. And now this is a 7-year-old, never had a piano lesson in her life. She actually pushed the seat aside because she was too short to sit on the piano stool and put her feet on the pedals. She put her hands on that keyboard. And it was like someone who had been playing piano their entire life. She played that song, Please Be Patient With Me. I mean, and rocking it like she was in some major Baptist church somewhere, feet on the pedal and everything, playing that song. And we just stood there with our mouths open. We were just shocked that she came, she went and played the piano like that. And when she came out of it, she wasn't able to play the next day. She didn't know, she had never played the piano before in her life.
Dana, wow. It's funny you should share that story because Mary Lou told me one time that sometimes she would sit at the piano and she said her fingers would just move across the keyboards like a spirit had just entered her and she just played the piano. So and Mary Lou herself had that experience.
In terms of what you were just talking about, which we talked about that before, was the fact that when your mother was in Nigeria, my partner, Norma Lewis, who now lives outside of London, and myself, and her husband was going to be part of it. Your mother was supposed to come and meet with us. And we waited and nothing happened. So I came back to New York.
A story though about spirit, which I think is interesting to share. When Dan and I were children, my mother would take us to a lot of United Nations receptions. So we would always get pictures with different heads of state because we were the only children there. But we were at one party in Riverdale where somebody at the Liberian mission, as a matter of fact, the ambassador of Liberia, and someone came over to my mother and said to her, come to the back because there was a secret meeting being held with Patrice Lumumba and some people from the Liberian mission. So we went back and just as we got there, Lumumba was entering his limo. And I was an avid autograph collector as a child. I asked if I could have his autograph. He didn't quite understand what I meant. So another man explained to him. Lumumba signed the autograph. But as he was signing the book, my body became ice cold. And my mother said, oh, he's coming back in a few months. And I looked up at her and said, Mom, he's not coming back. So what are you talking about? What are you talking about? I said, while he was signing my book, my body became ice cold and I was just told he's going to be killed. And she said, how could you say such a horrible thing? I said, Mommy, it's not me. This is what I was just told. He's going to be killed.
Because I remember Marsha and I sitting on this big bat party is going on at this beautiful mansion. And Marsha and I are sitting alone on the steps and Marsha started crying. And I said, asked her, why are you crying? She said, because we're never going to see him again. We're never going to see him again.
What is on the horizon for you? What are you looking forward to doing?
Durga and I have collaborated recently on an album because we've been doing shows together now for probably the last 5 or 6 years, different Pink Floyd tribute bands that have us to perform lead vocals where we get to sing some of our favorite Pink Floyd songs as lead singers, not doing background. So we built a bit of a following doing that. I took a bit of a break to start a family after the Rolling Stones, and I didn't go back to it until 2010 with Rod Stewart. We both worked with many other Pink Floyd tribute bands since Pink Floyd broke up. So we've got fans, and we decided to do something as a duo. We have a friend named Dave Kirzner, who we were performing background vocals with on Cruise to the Edge. It's a rock cruise that's hosted by the 70s band Yes. And we decided to do it. And finally, we got it done last year. So that's what we're focusing on right now, is promoting that album. It's called Black Floyd. We decided to name it that as not only a play on words with Pink Floyd, but to also recognize the Black musicians who inspired rock and roll that most British bands will acknowledge. The name Pink Floyd came from two blues men, Pink Anderson and Floyd Council. And we've done 7 Pink Floyd songs, including Great Gig in the Sky, the one that you mentioned earlier that you like, and some originals.
Those originals were co-written. One song I wrote with John Karen, who was the keyboard player with Pink Floyd when we toured with them and went on to play with Roger Waters. Guy Pratt, who was the bass player, who also now plays with Nick Mason, and Dave Kirzner, as we mentioned before, and a song that Lorelei wrote with Lemmy Kilmister, who was the legendary singer from Motorhead. Fantastic man, God rest his soul. So yes, we're looking to promote Black Floyd and possibly set up a tour with the two of us. We love working together. We've been singing together since we were children. I think back on it now, Mom must have been exhausted when she came home from a full day's work at the office. And I learned later how much, because I worked in her office as a medical assistant off and on for 20 years. It's hard work working those hours, but she'd come home, Lorelei and I would be with our little guitars and little Beatle boots and saying, look, we worked out something for you. And we'd sing for her. And she would always be really receptive and really supportive. But because we grew up singing together, now it's effortless. We love singing together, not only because we are so comfortable working with each other, but we both, in our own careers, become extremely professional. We know that we both bring it. And it's fun working together. We love each other. So it's fun. I work with a lot of different tribute bands. She's been working with the Australian Pink Floyd for, as she said, 11 years now, or 10, whatever. Yeah, 10. And I started working. The first one was a band called The End in Argentina. They flew me out as a special guest. And that started this phase of my career. Mostly what I do to make a living is working with these tribute bands. And I fly from Argentina to Finland. And then I was able to start getting Lorelei in on these gigs with me. That's always really great. I look forward to doing more of that, as well as promoting Black Floyd, as well as I have a new Blue Pearl album that we've been trying to finish the mixing. We've been working on this for a couple of years now because we've been doing it on our own. I want to get the Blue Pearl album out this year. And I've been asked to do a blues project here in Los Angeles. And I'm going to get some pretty cool people in on that. I want to get that done this year as well, too.
I also have to give credit that one of the positive things that came out of this pandemic was I was on tour with the Ozzy Floyd when it happened and ended up staying with my good friend, Dave Fowler,
yeah.
who, because we hadn't finished the album and we needed to get it done and we were off, he offered to help us get it finished. And he did such a beautiful job finishing the production that we had all started. And I have to give him a lot of credit for that and say, even though the pandemic has been horrific as far as us not being able to make a living touring like we're used to, it was great to be able to come out with this creative project. And it also gave me a chance to learn about editing. Now, I'm no Franklin Mano by any means. I'm truly a novice, but at least it allowed me to learn how to do something I could do to help represent what we were trying to say.
What I want you to do is to stand up and let people see your jewelry behind you.
Oh.
See, I have to promote you now.
I've got jewelry all over my room, as you can see. And I've got a whole bunch of beads on my bed right now. This is like where I work. I have a website, Jewelry by Lorelei, and people can see what I've got there. This is my personal pairs, chokers and earrings. And I love making stuff. And that's something I learned from our third part of the family, Kathy, our other stepmother. She taught me how to make jewelry when I was 12. We were spending some summertime with Daddy. I'll always remember that summer. That's the year that Dr. My Eyes came out, the Jackson Brown song.
Jackson Brown.
I started making jewelry because a friend of mine, the medium, she lives in Canada, named Jay Lane, and she had offered to do some readings for me, so I gave her some jewelry in exchange. And she was like, oh, my friends are drooling over your jewelry. You really ought to sell it, and I'll help you. So she started sharing with her people, and between the two of us, we started building the brand. And that's been helping me get by week. It's certainly not making the kind of money I was making touring, but it's helping buy some meals and keep the lights on.
I found a few things that I could show. This is the book that ended up in the museum, The Black Woman. And then I found one of my ads that I used to do. This was one of the liquor companies. Mm-hmm. This was a scene from the Cotton Club Gala. Can you see that?
Ooh.
Yeah, this was our
little the corners up a little bit more.
Okay, that's beautiful.
Can you see that?
Yes.
Yeah, that was from one of our numbers from the Cotton Club Gala.
So what's on the horizon for you?
I'm still writing music. I have a song that I wrote. I've been thinking about getting Durga to sing it because it's called, it's very sort of risque, called Cookie Jar.
That reminds you of Durga, huh?
So Durga and I have hung out together sometimes.
I do dance music. I'm the dance diva. House and techno and dance music.
And the song says basically, if you can't handle the cookie, don't mess with the cookie jar. The recipe is good and the cookie tastes so sweet. But every time he bite the cookie break his teeth. Oh, he to the cookie. He want to stay up all night with the cookie.
I'm going to say that it has been such a pleasure to be able to meet all of you all, although I did know Dana previously.
We may end up getting together because that one of the things I didn't mention, because that's why I was in Montserrat. I want to open a school for the arts there. So this way I can bring in all my family members and friends who have a particular specialty in the arts. We want to open the Paca Academy there and bring in my nephew, Jeremiah, to teach chess and let people walk out in the street and be together and enjoy life, especially young people, to learn. Marcia can do acting, Lorelei and Durga can do music, and we have a lot of things. And I've been doing a lot of directing. of theater. That was one reason I was together. I mentioned Starletta Dupois earlier, because I have a play called Millennium Seven about two old people, a Jewish woman and a Black woman, who are stuck in a nursing home and they can't get out. And so Starletta is to be one of those people. And I also have a play about the relationship between Marilyn Monroe and Ella Fitzgerald. They were best friends and people don't even know about that. One of the missions of Picat is to educate while we entertain. So that's one thing I want to do, is to entertain, but educate people through.
Dana, I don't know if you know this, but last year before the lockdown started, I was working, Michael Nouri, my friend from Flashdance, is teaching a fabulous acting class, and he was having me in as a guest teacher. So I've been teaching acting too.
Well, that's a good thing, because Picat Academy will be up and running before we know it.
Cool.
As I was getting ready to say, it was been a wonderful time. Great show. Great show.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for tuning in this week. Hope you enjoyed this show about stuff. See you next time.
The Break Store. Unique branded gifts for the holidays, birthdays, or just because. Visit us at www.thebreakstore.com. Hit the right black get in touch button.